The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll continue to dig into the September issue of Our State Magazine, which features articles all about North Carolina's rural roots. Our first article is entitled, Where Print Lives. Across North Carolina, small-town newspapers make a major impact by reporting on the people and events that shape local communities. When Hiram Lupton arrives at the annual school spelling bee in Pamlico County, the kids begin whispering that a local celebrity has arrived. Everybody knows Hiram. He's the sole staff writer and photographer for the Pamlico News and Oriental. You can hear them say, "Hey, the newspaper guy's here," Lupton says, laughing. Local journalism is the glue that binds a community. It can stoke debate while transcending political and cultural divisions. Which inter-county rival won the high school softball game? What's the city council up to? And did Russ ever find the fox that ate his chickens? Scrappy and resilient community weeklies across North Carolina, like the Pamlico News, Randolph Hub, and the paper in Burke County, are devoted to serving their readers in defiance of national trends. Since 2005, the United States has lost more than a fourth of its newspapers, 2,500, according to the Local News Initiative, based at Northwestern University. Six counties in North Carolina have no newspaper at all, and many other papers are being purchased by conglomerates or hedge funds with no connections to their communities. While many papers offer a digital subscription, their core readers want their news in print. They treasure the ritual of unfolding the paper and spreading it on the breakfast table. They want to see photos of their children and grandchildren spiking a volleyball or accepting a diploma. They want to clip out stories and paste them in a scrapbook, their fingertips stained with ink. Our first paper is called the Pamlico News, that's out of Oriental. Launched in 1968, the Pamlico County News, as it was known then, has served coastal communities for more than half a century. In 1977, it was purchased by Henry and Nancy Winfrey. Their home on Broad Street in Oriental became the newspaper's office. Several of the couple's children went on to work at the paper, including daughter Frida, who served as editor for about 10 years. Now, a son, Sandy Winfrey, the last surviving member of the immediate family, is editor and publisher. His hands have been calloused not by the tap, tap, tap of a keyboard, but by 40 years of building houses. Sandy could have sold the paper, but chose not to. "My dad was so proud of it," he says. "It's a service to the community." His wife, Catherine, has another word for it. "We're a dinosaur," she jokes. Catherine is the office manager of the Pamlico News, which publishes weekly. She's encouraging a new generation of readers to understand the importance of local news. "I tell teachers, you need to give every student a newspaper so they can read it and feel it." Joe Miller, who has lived half a dozen major cities, landed in Pamlico County and designs the paper. Delivery driver Neil McGraw services the paper boxes in the post office. His beat-up late 90s GMC Jimmy that he used to make his rounds with is now for sale for a mere $500. He recently upgraded to a Chevy Blazer. Originally from Long Island in New York, Janine Russo has worked at the Pamlico News for 16 years. The staff calls her the heartbeat of the paper because of her many roles: bookkeeper, ad and circulation manager, and office manager. "No 2 days are the same," she says. "That's why I like it so much." The phone rings, and Russo answers. "I'd like to give you some money," says the caller, who's renewing his subscription. Those calls are common as the community relies on the Pamlico News for their information. "We take what we put in the paper very seriously," Russo says. Hiram Lupton keeps track of the goings-on in 9 towns spread over 336 square miles of the county. One day he's covering the Pamlico County High School wrestling team. The next, he's attending a contentious Oriental Town Board meeting. The day after that, a rabies vaccination clinic in Bayboro. Readers have thanked him for evenly covering the issues that are important to the community. Lupton adds. They'll say, I appreciate that article. I now understand the issue better. The phone rings. A man named Daniel wants to drop off a photo of his daughter who's graduating from high school. He arrives just minutes later. When's the paper coming out? He asks. Wednesday, Catherine Winfrey replies. Every Wednesday, without fail. This little paper is determined to survive, she says. And the next paper is called The Paper, out of Morganton. In Morganton, if you want to know why one downtown restaurant is suing the city, another violated fire codes, and a third is shorthanded after several staff walked off the job, Alan Van Noppen, publisher of The Paper, will ensure you get the facts. When Van Noppen and Bill Poteet began meeting with Burke County business leaders about 2 years ago, the duo had no staff, no office, no one to print the paper. All they had was a logo, a hat emblazoned with that logo, their credentials, and a vision. You know, looking back, that's probably as insane as saying, we're going to come out with a printed community newspaper, Van Noppen says. But what we heard from all corners was, it's badly needed. And in my heart, I knew it was the right thing to do. Since then, Van Noppen, the publisher, and Poteet, the editor emeritus, both old-school journalists, have assembled an experienced staff that includes advertising reps, circulation staff, and reporters, all of whom fan out to reach the heart of Burke County, Morganton, Valdez, Glen Alpine, Drexel, Rutherford College. The paper covers the requisite government meetings and unflinchingly tackles controversial issues such as the Confederate monument on the courthouse square, homelessness, and drug abuse, in addition to the community newspaper staples such as profiles of prominent people and family businesses, tax revenue trends, and education news. We have strived from day one to be a community builder through accurate, responsible, and thorough coverage, Van Noppen says, to spur conversation, to spur debate. After less than a year in business, the paper was named by the Trade Magazine editor and publisher one of news media's 10 to watch for its innovations in publishing local news. And this year, the staff brought home 17 awards from the NC Press Association. Every Friday night, the circulation team begins delivering the paper to subscribers. Van Noppen says, the next morning, all over Burke County, readers wander outside in their bathrobes or sweatpants, coffee mug in hand, and grab their newspaper. When they don't get their newspaper, we hear about it, which to me is the sound of music. That's telling me they miss it, says Van Noppen. So I say, I'm very sorry, and we rush one out in the next 10 minutes. But it's good news from my publishing perspective. And the last paper is called The Hub, and it's based in Asheboro. You don't have to be famous to appear in the Randolph Hub. You don't have to run for office, get caught speeding, or die, although that could make the paper too. Everybody has a story, says Ray Crisco, editor and founder of the Randolph Hub, based in Asheboro. You find that any time you talk to someone, you come up with a great story, and no one would ever know about it because most of the time, they're not well known at all. A veteran editor and sports writer, Crisco retired from the Courier Tribune in Asheboro in 2020, disillusioned with the future of local newspapers. But soon he felt restless. It's a noble profession. It's in your blood, Crisco says of the craft of journalism. I thought about it, and eventually I just said, I'm going to do it. From a downtown office in a historic house that includes the Brightside Gallery and Carriage House Tea, Crisco launched the Randolph Hub. First, he mailed a survey to 1,800 people asking them what kinds of stories they wanted to read. About 500 people responded. Articles about local businesses, feature stories, pieces about their neighbors. It's the thing that the newspaper industry got away from, Crisco says, and by doing that, they're leaving behind an entire group of people who want something to tell them what's going on in the community. No national news, no state news, just local news, covered by a handful of fellow former journalists for a county of 146,000 residents. The Hub's stories cover all the bases. Why residents' water bills are going up. How the old Randolph Savings and Loan Building became a historic landmark. When the Toyota megasite northwest of Liberty will begin making batteries for electric vehicles. It's down-home stuff happening here in this community, Crisco says. It's public information that people want. His approach resonates with readers. They're just so appreciative, Crisco says. I've just been amazed. Media researchers at Northwestern University have found that reviving local news involves reestablishing some form of local ownership that is accountable to the community where the news outlet is located. That's what the Pamlico News, the paper, and Randolph Hub are achieving. It's a venture worth replicating. If I were a rich man, Crisco says, I'd do this in communities all over the state, because I bet you there are pockets of people like that everywhere. And this is proof. The next article is also about a paper. It's called The Family Business. When you grow up in Clinton and your dad runs one of the few newspapers in your small town, being part of the staff isn't really an option. Wednesday afternoons, we put the paper to bed. It was a family affair. My siblings and I, along with several other local teenagers, were drafted to insert the various inside sections, sports, advertising circulars, and so forth, into the front section to create the Samsonian, a weekly that my father co-owned in Clinton until he retired in 1986. We rolled and rubber-banded the mixed state singles and then stuffed them into large canvas bags that, around dusk, we deposit on the loading dock of the local post office. Then attention turned to next week's news. Running a small-town newspaper was the only thing my father ever wanted to do. He was fortunate enough to study journalism at UNC Chapel Hill on the GI Bill. He took his first job out of college at the Chatham News in Siler City, where he spent 19 years as a reporter. I was the news staff, he said, years later in an article commemorating his 37 years in the business. I took all the pictures and wrote all the news and typed all the correspondence and the weddings. Everything had to be typed on yellow paper in those days and given to a linotype operator. He made a proof, and it had to be read for corrections. I tell you, it took all week to put out a paper. Starting in the mid-60s, when he went to work for the Samsonian, my father wrote editorials in a weekly column called Making the Rounds. It featured commentary on goings-on in the community as well as the antics of his children. It's a cliche that everybody knows everyone's business in a small town, but my father knew almost everyone, if not their business. He knew store owners from selling ads, and he knew the school board and city council from covering their meetings. He got to know a lot of people from spelling their names wrong, a grave mistake unless the name in question happened to appear in the police blotter. Newspapers in general serve a dual and somewhat contradictory purpose. On the one hand, they are a business. They make their money selling ads and subscriptions. On the other, their purpose is loftier, to set a kind of moral tone, to rise above commerce and opine on matters most pertinent to the community. One of the things that my father learned in college was that the purpose of journalism is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. He took those words to heart. He spoke his mind during the era of Jim Crow and stepped on every other toe with his left-leaning editorials in a small conservative town. A particular target was Jesse Helms. But he also made friends with most of the people he alienated politically. Maybe this is because he was, or at least his job was, indispensable at the time. Everyone took the paper, quote unquote. Once, when I asked somebody if they took the paper, they said, "No, I paid for it." If they didn't subscribe, they bought it from one of the dozens of paper boxes placed around the county. I don't think my father knew everyone who took the paper. But he did know several who no longer did, as they had a habit of writing letters to the editor demanding that their subscription be canceled for some reason or another. There were dozens of reasons to take the paper, from the lurid pictures of car wrecks and about-to-be-blown-up whiskey stills on the front page, to the athletic, complete coverage of local high school sports, to the morbid. One of my sisters still gets the paper just to read the obituaries. People took the paper to find out when the J.C.'s would hold their womanless beauty pageant, the Rotary Club their pancake breakfast, local churches their fundraising fish fries. There was a religion column, a cooking column, and columns from correspondents who lived in what appeared to be a remote part of the county. My favorite was 7 Mile Hopewell column from somewhere up near Newton Grove, written by someone named Big Sis in a style that I later learned was called Stream of Consciousness. The news from 7 Mile Hopewell prepared me for the experiments of Faulkner and other modernists. I remember reading Gertrude Stein for the first time and thinking, heck, she's got nothing on Big Sis. And with Big Sis, I could figure out who motored up to Raleigh to visit their cousin recovering from gallbladder surgery at Rex Hospital. Of course, there was some non-local news gathered from the AP Wire and Ask Ann Landers and the comics. Occasionally, in order for all the ads to fit, a comic strip had to be omitted. Here came more irate phone calls or sometimes visits to the office. There were people in and out of the office all day to the extent that I don't know how my father or his staff got anything done. Though it did occur to me that sometimes it wasn't necessary to go out and find the news. It came walking through the door. Although my father was on good terms with most everyone, he generally refused to do business with stores that didn't advertise. His reasoning was simple. If they're not putting a dime in my pocket, why should I put a dime in theirs? But it alienated his children, who were forced to wear off-brand blue jeans and can only window shop at the local sporting goods store. I like to believe that however ticked off I was at not getting first crack at a pair of Wranglers, my sacrifices were small in the service of what the newspaper did: bring us all together, provide a stronger sense of community. And there are the memories. The rhythm of putting out the paper, which was the rhythm of our family's lives, the long and industrious hours of Monday and Tuesday, the intense push of Wednesday, the short but sweet relief of Thursday when my father played golf and my mother did the week's grocery shopping. How could I forget the poetry, Wilmington Wade, Warsaw, Mount Olive, of the destination of the papers we stuffed into those canvas bags, the thrill of holding the finished paper in hand, knowing that people were waiting for it, and, of course, the smell everywhere, in the car, on our clothes, even at home, of ink. Our next article is entitled Shared Blessings. Like many congregations across the state, members of Franklinton United Methodist Church support each other through life's hardships. And for this small group of big-hearted people, that benevolence reaches deep into the surrounding communities. And there's a beautiful picture here of the sanctuary, looking away from the front of the sanctuary toward the back of the sanctuary, the beautiful stained glass windows and pointed doors and great, nice woodworking along the ceiling, buttressing the ceiling. Before becoming pastor of Franklinton United Methodist Church, Johnny Lierna attended the Duke Divinity School. He was then ordained and as an elder and is now studying in the school's Doctor of Ministry program. Pastor Johnny Irena faces the sanctuary of Franklinton United Methodist Church, where colored light filters through the stunning stained glass windows and intricately carved wooden beams arch across a vaulted ceiling. As he delivers his Sunday sermon, he tells the story of being in a boat on the ocean for the first time at the age of 3. He was afraid and his father held him. He relates his story to that of Jesus and his disciples in a boat on the sea during a terrible storm. "Why are you afraid?" Jesus asked his disciples. "Have you no faith?" When our lives are affected by one storm after another, we tend to forget who is on the ship with us, Irena preaches, looking out over his parishioners scattered about the pews. Remember, we will always have our Lord Jesus Christ with us to embrace us and give us comfort. In the 180 years since Franklinton United Methodist Church was founded, just 2 years after the incorporation of the town, its members have seen marriages and births, illnesses and deaths. They've seen peace and war, prosperity and poverty, joy and tragedy, but always the church has been there to remind them that God will carry them through the storm. There's no storm on this Sunday. It's hot and sunny, and the air condition is broken. But the warmth in the sanctuary, 83 degrees, the thermostat reads, reflects the warmth that the people sitting on the curved wooden pews feel for one another and for the surrounding community. The church sits on Main Street, just past the shops and restaurants of Franklinton's small downtown. The brick Gothic Revival building, its shingled turrets and arched stained glass windows, is the second that the congregation has occupied, and it was built in 1891. Each Sunday after the service, congregants proceed to the Hospitality Center, a small room off the side of the sanctuary, where they catch up over sandwiches, cakes, and coffee. They ask after each other's health, how their families are doing, and they offer to help one another. The number of people attending the services started dwindling in the late 1980s when nearby cotton mills began to close and folks moved away. The members who remained are older. Their children and grandchildren have moved away, too. But the 30 to 35 members who are here feel strong ties to this church and to each other. Allie Watts Casey has been a member of the Franklinton UMC for about 9 years. She joined after her previous church became so large that the members didn't know each other well. Everybody here was very open, very welcoming, and very loving, she says. She now knows the other members well enough to call them at any time, day or night, if I need help for anything. Eva Conrad has been a member since she moved to the area in 2005. I felt at home right away, she says. When her husband had Alzheimer's and she was sick with pneumonia, she was too tired to cook. Before I knew it, every day somebody else from the church was at the door with meals, she says. It made it a lot easier. They were there when you need them. The church may not have a large congregation, but its footprint on the community spans decades, counties, languages, and socioeconomic statuses. It has a congregation that's always asking, where is there a need and how can we help? What more can we do? We're very small, member Mary McGee says, small but mighty. Irena first experienced the feeling of community among a congregation in his native Peru. He grew up Catholic in Chimbote, a coastal city north of the capital city of Lima. After moving to Lima as a teenager in 1986, his cousin invited him to play guitar for a youth group at his Methodist church. Irena was not particularly religious and never heard of the Methodist church, but he agreed. I think those songs touched my heart, he said. The more time Irena spent with the church, the more he felt that God was calling him to serve. He attended seminary in Peru, but the school shut down before he was able to finish his studies. A friend of his, a former professor at Duke University, recommended that Irena apply to the divinity school. Irena moved to Durham and completed his Master of Divinity in 2021, then was appointed pastor of Franklinton UMC in 2022. It's not easy for a Hispanic pastor with some accent and some errors in speaking to be accepted, he says, but I think this congregation is very kind, and I think they pay more attention to what I say rather than how I say it. The parishioners offer that same acceptance to the surrounding community. Because rural areas are remote, Irena says, they can sometimes be overlooked by government programs, so having church support is even more important. According to the United States Census Bureau, Franklin County has an annual per capita income of $33,313 compared to $50,188 in neighboring Wake County. And 10.9% of people are living in poverty here compared with 7.5% in Wake County. This makes the services that the church offers, a food pantry and a low-cost daycare, critical to the county. When Irena joined Franklinton UMC, the church was operating a food pantry that gave away 10 to 20 bags a month. As a Spanish speaker, he was able to go to a local income, predominantly Hispanic neighborhood and promote the service, passing out pamphlets and building relationships with the residents. The church now gives away more than 60 bags of food, cleaning supplies, and toiletries each month. When Hispanic recipients arrive at the food pantry, Irena usually gives them their bags and chats with them, asking how they were doing. Once a woman began to cry, telling him that her father had had an accident and was faring poorly. She was unable to visit him because he was in Mexico. Irena prayed with her. We offered food, but we discovered that people needed more than that. The daycare was started in the early 70s as a response to the local need for affordable child care. Offering services at a lower cost than others in the area, the Franklinton UMC Child Care Center is one of the few financially feasible child care options for many nearby families. The daycare even accepts vouchers from social services and at one time was the only child care service in the area to do so. McGee has been on the board for the daycare more than 10 years. She explains that because the church and daycare are next door to a school, teachers in the past have been able to accept jobs in this rural area because of the affordable child care option close by. Every 2 weeks, Irena hosts chapel for the kids in the adjacent sanctuary. He sits on the floor with them as they watch a short cartoon Bible story, and then he contextualizes the message by helping them relate it to their own lives. He also brings his guitar and sings Christian songs for them, finishing with a prayer. When he engages with the children, he uses simple Spanish expressions like hola, amigos, or adios. The children have learned the expressions and can repeat them back to him. It's a very emotional moment because they're engaging with not only the work of God, but they're also engaging with me because of my identity, he says. Irena feels grateful to God for being appointed to the Franklinton UMC because of the congregation's beneficence. Also, I feel challenged because there's a lot of talent here, generosity and skills. So the challenge to be a good spiritual leader, but also a good organizer, to work with the children, to do this type of ministry within the community. The final hymn sung on this Sunday, two dozen voices lift to heavens in unison, proclaiming, "How firm a foundation, you saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word." How firm a foundation has this church building, which has stood since 1891. How firm a foundation has this congregation, which has worshipped since 1844. How firm a foundation have these members in their faith and their love for one another and for their rural community. How firm a foundation which has weathered every storm and will weather many more. And within these walls, all who enter, church members, community members, children of the daycare, will be embraced and find comfort. To wrap up this episode, we'll cover the Tar Heel timeline, which is called the long game. With no shortage of beautiful landscapes and sporting residents, North Carolina has been a golfer's paradise for decades. Starting in 1894, after hunting at Asheville's new sporting club damages farmland, members transitioned to golf, eventually known as Asheville Country Club. The facility is one of the oldest of its kind in the state. Then in 1898, Pinehurst constructs a nine-hole golf course that later becomes Pinehurst No. 1, the village's first 18-hole layout. Around circa 1916, a shipping magnate has a miniature golf course built at his second Pinehurst residence. The course, dubbed Thistledew, allegedly a Scottish iteration of Thistledew, is the first miniature course in the country. 1938. Sam Snead wins the first Greater Greensboro Open. The tournament, now in the Wyndham, now called the Wyndham Championship, is held every August at Sedgefield Country Club. 1954. Fayetteville resident Don Clayton creates the game of putt-putt, a version of miniature golf where each hole is a par two. Patrons at his courses pay 25 cents per round. 1955. Six black Greensboro residents play nine holes at the segregated Gillespie Golf Course before being arrested. The men's actions lead to the integration of the course and help inspire the Greensboro Four sit-in. 1970s. After playing at Linville Golf Club, Augusta National Golf Club chairman Clifford Roberts orders a high-purity quartz sand from Spruce Pine. Since then, Augusta has often used Mitchell County sand in its bunkers. Moving to the present, USGA opens a new campus, Golf House Pinehurst. The town hosts its fourth U.S. Open in June of 24. Well, that sound means that we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thanks for calling.